And welcome to our study. Today's date is September the 19th, 2014. Our study is entitled Wilderness Justice Journey. This is series 31, and it's the second study in the series. Our first study showed us that though Luke was not a disciple, he was a Christian reporter who had access to the disciples and recorded their testimony to the world. In this sense, the life-saving testimony of Jesus delivered to the said disciples was broadcast by Luke to the world. He was a ready writer. Such is important for us to recognize because, although we know this instinctively, it should by now dawn upon us that not everybody, not every disciple, can record their memoirs. Remembering and putting it down in writing are two different things. Not everybody can interview. Luke did these things for them and for our benefit. And we proved that he was a comforter-inspired reporter. Hence, his work has blazed our dark trail through the perilous wilderness. From his unique testimony, we can discern the full identity of the Lord and the Star of David that has been promised to the world. Today, we are forwarding our theme that's really embedded in Numbers chapter 1 and chapter 2 that describes the journey and the sojourn of the church. We can open up the scriptures and find a remarkable event that occurred in the history of the church's development and its advancement. We've discussed quite a bit about Jacob's travels, how he left his father's house, Isaac's house, and journeyed to Bethel. And then he worked for 20 years in Padan Aram and continued forward to Peniel and Shechem. Then he returned back to Beersheba. All of those events, we are told, and has been opened up to us to be applicable with much meaning and significance for the advances of the church. One experience, though, that occurred in Jacob's life that has not been emphasized, I dare say, has not been elucidated, involves his journey through Egypt. You know, after Jacob finished his excursions, a lot of events occurred in the land. We're all familiar with those. We're familiar how he thought that he lost his favorite son, Joseph. We're familiar how there was a drought. But at the end of that experience, you have Jacob the man settled in the land of Canaan. Mind you, this was the land that the Lord promised would be his inheritance forever. But one day he wakes up from a dream that changed the course of the church's history. The dream commissioned him to go down into Egypt. Let's read in Genesis chapter 46, verses 1 through 6. And Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices unto the God of his father Isaac. And God spake unto Israel in the visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, Here am I. And he said, I am God, the God of thy fathers. Fear not to go down into Egypt, for I will there make of thee a great nation. I will go down with thee into Egypt, and I will also surely bring thee up again, and Joseph shall put his hand upon thine eyes. And Jacob rose up from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried Jacob their father, and their little ones, and their wives, in the wagons which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. And they took their cattle and their goods, which they had gotten in the land of Canaan, and came unto Egypt. Jacob and all his seed with him. I find this a remarkable occurrence, because you see now that the church took another advancing step. You know how in Numbers, where the Lord said that with regard to the tabernacle, the Levites shall pitch it, and they shall take it down again. And we saw that that signified that it was a church on the move. Well, this is likewise a church that was on the move, but quite surprisingly, Jacob has spent all his life making moves and maneuvers. And now he's told to uproot himself again from the land that he had assumed would be his forever. Jacob didn't complain. He didn't resist. He took his entire family and all of his belongings and relocated in Egypt. But it really wasn't that simple. If you know the story, you've read it, and you know that the Lord had the position and posture the house of Jacob to be ready to make this move. No food in Canaan. The food was in Egypt. The supplies were in Egypt. Jacob's son Joseph was seated in power in Egypt. And I just can't help but realize, appreciate, and understand that these were steps that were made in advance to encourage Jacob to go down into Egypt. That was an important stop on the church's itinerary. I say there's a lot of lessons that we could extrapolate from that. Another one is, quite surprisingly, and I'm going to put this in theological parlance, because it has special meaning that will be made clearer and even more germane as we advance in the study, Jacob was still being shepherded by Christ. Well, you got to think about that a little. You know, David said, "The Lord is my shepherd. He leadeth me in paths of righteousness." That means that you do not, as Jacob did not, as David did not, you do not advance on your own genius, on your own wisdom, on your own thoughts. You depend upon the Lord to take you. And even though he leads you through the valley of the shadow of death, you're comfortable with his leadership. And this lesson really has great applicability, because we see that all the hardships and the heartache that afflicted Jacob, we see that even his son Benjamin, he was afraid to send him down into Egypt for fear that he would lose that son. He had a lot of anxiety. Imagine waking up and seeing that your favorite son was killed by beasts, as it's reported to you. How do you come to grips with that? How does the Lord allow something like that to happen to you? How is it that you harmonize that with the Lord's promises that he will be with you and protect you? Jacob only understood at the end of the event and realized as a result that these things all happen so that he could be embraced by Joseph and encouraged to return to the land. I say that because it suggests that Jacob had not yet overcome. Jacob's victory and his name change to Israel pertains to our day, the day when he actually overcomes. That means that the Lord does not have to hide these events from us, and we do not now feel aggrieved by the episodes that occur in our lives, because we realize today, for the first time, we learn righteousness by faith, or Christ, our righteousness. We realize that he leads us. We are converted from being shepherded by Christ to being his shepherds. So think of a shepherd. he takes the sheep. They don't know what pasture they're going to go to. They depend upon the shepherd. They don't know how they're going to be protected from the lion, the tiger, and the bear. The shepherd is there to take care of those things. They don't know if there's water. Well, the shepherd's not going to lead you to pasture if he can't give you water. That's the burden of the shepherd. You have the sheep who are reliant upon the shepherd. And I see here in this experience that we've just read from Genesis chapter 46 that Jacob was being shepherded by the Lord. You have a man, Christ, leading the church. See if you can integrate these symbolisms into the study as we advance. Because to be a shepherd, that means you have to be a man. To be a sheep, that's a depiction of an animal. A creature that does not have the capacity to know how to take care of itself. Therefore, there was a hidden path that was mapped out on Jacob's itinerary, his GPS system, that he wasn't aware of, that meant that he had to go back through Egypt. I say go back because Isaac and Abraham had bad experiences in Egypt. And now Jacob is told to go down there. The Lord knew that it may seem contradictory. That's why he told him, I'm going to take you to Egypt, I'll be with you, and I'm going to bring you back. Therefore, we should really understand more fully now, at the end of the day, that we have never really had the capacity to know what the Lord had in store for us tomorrow. In fact, Jacob didn't know that he was not going to come back alive. He didn't know that his children were going to go down into Egypt and they were going to go into bondage. He didn't know the great manifestations that Moses would work miraculously to liberate his people. He had no concept or idea. It was a hidden path. I can't really get away from the impressive dream. It capsulizes the church's experience as it comes to the point in time where we come to the end of our trail in our journey. And we too are shocked as we advance along the way. Let's reread an important facet of this journey that I would venture to say has never been emphasized before. But it's a burden that has been placed on my heart that I need to teach. Genesis chapter 46, just picking up in verse 3 now. The Lord said, I am God, the God of thy father. Fear not to go down into Egypt, for I will there make of thee a great nation. Verse 26. All the souls that came with Jacob into Egypt, which came out of his loins, besides Jacob's sons' wives, all the souls were 66. So 66 people went with Jacob into Egypt. 66 people. See, we as Adventists have been fixated on growing the church. This has been our passion. As we became Davidians, we became even more gripped with growing the church. Jacob had 66 people. He seemed to be settled on that number. This seems to be enough. But the Lord, you see, was more passionate about growing the church than Jacob, so much so that he wanted them to go to Egypt. What about the girls in Canaan, Lord? What about the girls in Czechoslovakia? What about the girls in Peru? In China? No. I want you to grow the church in Egypt. You think about that now. You ever much thought to that? The Egyptian females married to Hebrew sons. Because, I mean, they went down there with wives. But they weren't not going to be incestuous. They were down there for several generations. They went down there with 66. And you'd be surprised how many people they came out of Egypt with. They had to have a lot of wild African sex. At the Lord's behest. Let's focus on that a little bit more. Verse 12 of Genesis 46. Who would think that God would engineer dates, sexual interludes for Jacob's sons? Who would think that? We seem to think of God in a narrow sense. Oh, I know, Lord, that you're holy. Therefore, you are going to increase my crops and protect them from the pestilence. And I know that you're going to send the rain. The Lord says, I can see even beyond that. I'm going to give to you sexual liaisons with the Lord's in generation. See if you can put your arms around this idea or this understanding. The Lord inherited Jacob, we're told, in Deuteronomy chapter 32. We've been there before. I don't need to turn your attention to that text particularly now. And what he has done is he is recreating his church from the dust of the earth. He is re-engineering his people. And this does not cast dispersions on the other peoples around the globe. They have talents and benefits that would likewise contribute to the growth of the church. If you read the experience of Israel, you'll see that people from different parts of the globe were inculcated into the church. And the church was scattered to different directions. But at its inception, when it only had 66 saints, the Lord wanted to grow them. He did that by taking them through Egypt. And that's why he says in Genesis chapter 46, just picking up in verse 3 now, for I will there make of thee a great nation. 66 people, not enough, Jacob. You've seen my addition skills. I saw that trick that you were playing with Laban where you were increasing the herds. And that was quite a fancy trick. Where do you see my multiplication skills? I can take you and multiply you mightily. I think it becomes apparent that when you deal with the Semitic people, when I say Semitic, the sons of Shem, whereby the church was engendered, Abraham and his people. You know, Rebekah wanted Jacob to go back to Padan Aram to find for himself a wife. She didn't want him to marry from the daughters of Canaan. But it seemed as if the Semitic people, as wonderful as they may have been, had a fertility problem. You saw that with Sarah, right? Now, Hagar, the Egyptian, had no problem reproducing. You saw that with Rachel. You saw that with Rebecca. She only produced two children. The Lord could have used a magic show and performed magic tricks, but he already had the people on the earth that he could use to solve his church's problems. And when he wanted them to become a mighty nation, he did that by taking them through Egypt. I find it remarkable, as we belabor this point just a little bit more, reading verse 12 of Genesis 46, "And the sons of Judah, Onan, and Shelah, and Phares, and Zerah. But and Onan died in the land of Canaan. And the sons of Phares were Hezron and Hamul." The reason why I cite that text is because you get an idea that when Jacob went to Egypt, because as we really travel through time and trace the journey of Jacob, we really need to do what Luke did in the days of the Lord and trace the Star of David. Because that's the light of the world. That's the star that the Lord engineers to teach us and to shepherd us. And Jacob had Judah, was his fourth son, I believe. And we're seeing here that Judah, through a Canaanite woman, had Phares. And I like to call him really Phares. Give him a Hispanic flair. And Phares had Hezron. That is the lineage of the Star of David. The only portion that existed when they went out, when they went down into Egypt. The reason why we need to trace the Star of David is because, as I told you, that he is going to become the Lord's shepherd. Let us digress and give a little bit of focus on that point by reading 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 10. And afterwards, we will flip quickly to Ezekiel chapter 34. He says, "Moreover, I will appoint a place for my people Israel." Regarding him, he's talking to David. Let's see if we get the lineage. Abraham, then Isaac, then Jacob, then Judah, then Perez, then Hezron, then Ram, then Aminadab, then Nishon, then Salmon. Then Salmon begot Boaz, and Boaz begot Obed, and Obed begot Jesse, and Jesse begot David. We can put this sort of in a clearer context now. 10 generations from Jacob, perhaps 11, you come up with David. And now, the promise to David in 2 Samuel chapter 7 says, "Moreover, I will appoint a place for my people, Israel." Until this happens, there are going to be a church on the move. This is the place where he's going to appoint. "And will plant them that they may dwell in a place of their own and move no more. Neither shall the children of wickedness afflict them anymore as before time." I just want you to see, because we're talking about wilderness justice journey. This is the day when affliction ends. This is the day when Israel has its final place. That time has not come yet, so we are making moves, not only physically, but theologically, each step along the way. And then we come to Ezekiel chapter 34, because you see now the star. In 2 Samuel chapter 7, he talks about the son of David that's going to emerge, is going to be the shepherd in that day. We've read that in the past. We're not going to read that now. It more clearly states it here in verses 23 and verses 24 of Ezekiel 34. "And I will set up one shepherd over them, and he shall feed them, even my servant David. He shall feed them, and he shall be their shepherd." That has special meaning to you now, because he is the one that determines the well-being of the sheep. It would be different if they were all shepherds. He would depict them maybe as the United States of America, where they all come together and vote and make decisions about the path that they're going to travel, the decisions that they're going to make, the renderings and the rulings of justice. But that's not what the Lord says. He says, I'll have one individual to do that. That person is going to be my servant, David. Of course, if we were to continue to read 2 Samuel chapter 7, we would see that he's going to come from David's loins. The name David is just used there figuratively to indicate the son of David. And I, the Lord, will be their God, and my servant David, a prince among them. I, the Lord, have spoken it. Gives us some sort of idea about the church itinerant. We're not always going to be on the move. We're not always going to be devoid of leadership. We're not always going to wake up from a dream, which some may consider a nightmare, telling us, look, you've got to leave now, it's time to go. This is the day when you're going to move no more. I like what we're told about this same day in Isaiah chapter 49. Let's read verses 5 and 6. And now saith the Lord, that formed me from the womb to be his servant, to bring Jacob again to him, though Israel be not gathered, yet shall I be glorious in the eyes of the Lord, and my God shall be my strength. And he said, it is a light thing that thou shouldest be my servant, to raise up the tribes of Jacob, and to restore the preserved of Israel. I will also give thee for a light to the Gentiles, that thou mayest be my salvation unto the end of the earth. Salvation comes through the light of Israel. This is why we need to anxiously look for the day when we come at the end of the journey. E.G. White pointed us to that day. We need to now merely hold on to the cords and look forward to our swing over the precipice, because it's a day of miracles. The Lord promised, though, to begin it all by taking them through Egypt. We read how Jacob went down and we saw that he had 66 souls with him, and not counting the wives of his sons, those that came out of his loins. So shockingly enough, we find in Numbers that merely 4 to 6 generations later, Egypt yielded to the Lord 600,000 sons. Let's read that. Numbers chapter 1. Well, I don't see why the Lord didn't take them down to Egypt. Why didn't he just give them a fertility pill? He did. He took them to Egypt. That was their fertility pill. Numbers chapter 1. And the Lord spake unto Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, in the tabernacle of the congregation, on the first day of the second month, in the second year after they were come out of the land of Egypt, saying, take ye the sum of all the congregation of the children of Israel, after their families, by the house of their fathers, with the number of their names, every male by their poll, from 20 years old and upward, all that are able to go forth to war in Israel, thou and Aaron shall number them by their armies. Okay, Moses and Aaron were given the responsibility now to count the number of the children of Israel. They were given very specific details. They were defined as the children of Israel merely by the house of their father. And that's why when you read this, it tells you the 12 sons of Jacob. It lists them, and it tells you in each category how many children came forth from Egypt as they are confined to that house. I used the number 600,000. It's a rounded number. It was a little more than that. I used that number, but that doesn't count the daughters. No offense. That doesn't count the feebled men. That doesn't count the young men under 20. If there was somebody that was handicapped or wheelchair bound because they couldn't go to battle, they didn't count them. What an amazing and marvelous blessing that the Lord bestowed upon them. And I say in just 4 to 6 generations. Verse 4 of Numbers 4. And with you there shall be a man of every tribe, every one head of the house of his fathers. in Numbers chapter 2, let's read verses 3 and 4, and then verse 32. And on the east side toward the rising of the sun shall they of the standard of the camp of Judah pitch throughout their armies. And Nashon, the son of Amminadab, shall be captain of the children of Judah. Okay, now we've discussed Nashon already. Again, you have Judah, then you had Perez, then you had Hezron, then you had Ram, then you had Amminadab, then you had Nashon. Judah, Perez, and Hezron were alive before they went to Egypt. So the numbers that are going to count had to occur from Hezron's children, from Ram's children, from Amminadab's children, and from Nashon's children. Now, I envision that Nashon may have been 80, 90 years old. Therefore, he may have had a couple generations after that. In fact, Salmon may have been born then, and perhaps even Boaz. But Nashon was elected by the Lord to be the Star of Judah. Luke clearly shows us it's the star through which the Son of David is going to emerge. In fact, he's of the parental lineage of David. And his host, and those that were numbered of them, were 74,600. 60 is what, 60, right? And 14,000 makes it 74,000. People fall into that category just in that period of time. The Lord told me he's going to make them a great mighty nation. He did a marvelous work with them. None should really ignore the contributions of the Egyptian sojourn because it gave to the children of Israel their beginning. Verse 32 of Numbers chapter 2. These are those which were numbered of the children of Israel by the house of their fathers. All those that were numbered of the camps throughout their host were 600,000 and 3,550. So that was the number that came forth. You mentioned the mixed multitude. The mixed multitude does not mean children that were born to Hebrews through Egyptian wives. The mixed multitude signifies that the sons that were born, that came out, that were born of Hebrew daughters to Egyptian men. There's an important lesson as far as the genetics that we need to understand. But before we get onto that, let us just focus on this antisocial stigma now that is brought to the fore. This surprise. We are told by David in Psalms chapter 45, verse 4. And in thy majesty ride prosperously because of truth and meekness and righteousness. And thy right hand shall teach thee terrible things. How is it that he's teaching them terrible things? Who wants to hear terrible things? How can we inculcate terrible things into our religion? When the star emerges, David says he's going to tell you some terrible things. They're called terrible things because they are things that you suspected to be different than what they actually were. They are violations to your social mores and the stigmas that prevail in your land. So that accordingly you think, well, that can't be right. That's a terrible thing. And this is why the Lord waited to this generation. Had he told Jacob after he left Shechem that you're going to go back to Egypt, Jacob said, well, that's a terrible thing. Jacob was still, during that phase of the church's experience, was being shepherded by the Lord. He can't teach everybody terrible things. But let it be clear and certain that to appreciate the Lord's righteousness and his judgment, there are going to be some things he's going to teach you that you're going to presume to be terrible. He makes the point again in Psalms chapter 65, verses 4 through 6. Blessed is the man whom thou choosest, and causest to approach unto thee, that he may dwell in thy courts. We shall be satisfied with the goodness of thy house, even of thy holy temple. by terrible things in righteousness, wilt thou answer us, O God of our salvation, who art the confidence of all the ends of the earth, and of them that are afar off upon the sea, which by his strength setteth fast the mountains, being girded with power. We have a clearer concept now of the terrible things. They're terrible things in righteousness. The only reason why we consider them terrible is because they disagree with our opinions of what's right and wrong. But if you would comply, you would see that they're righteous. Just like when you look back at the Egyptian sojourn, you see the Lord did a good thing. He blessed them in righteousness. But it's kind of shocking, though, isn't it, that the Lord would set up a lot of dates for the sons of Jacob so that they may not just have one wife, but may have six or seven wives. And that as a result, they would have women that could bear children and have their wombs open and have multiple children. It's a shocking doctrine. Because we never believed that the Lord was intimately involved in sex. We thought that's something we snuck off to do after we did our service for the Lord. You're sitting in church and you're thinking, well, after this is going to happen, after we get done with this, after I'm through pretending like I'm holy, I'm going to go home and I'm going to do some things that people in the church are not going to approve of. The Lord knew all along the promptings and the leadings of your heart. He put that within you. And this is the way that he reforged Jacob after his image. Think of some of the other shocking doctrines that we've learned to show you that there's been terrible things. Think of the doctrine of Jerusalem. We showed they're going to emerge from the sons of America's former slaves. And some folks thought that's too terrible. Think of the doctrine of Emmanuel, that he goes in unto the prophetess. Think of the doctrine of the prophetess. Think of the doctrine of the Jupiterian saints. Think of the emphasis of Mary being inseminated by the Father. It's a terrible thing, isn't it? In righteousness. Think of the nullification of Paul's work. Think of solar system creation. All these years we were thinking that in the 6 days of creation, the Lord created the entire universe. But now we understand and know that he only created the solar system during that span of time. Think of the fact that one man was to emerge to shine, and that man would have the seal that would win for us everlasting life. He'd be a light not only to Israel, but to the Gentiles, as we saw. Think of the concept of everlasting life. Shocking and surprising. Why do we think that's so terrible? I don't know. It's because our minds are not steeped in righteousness. Think of our acceptance of female and female sexuality. All along, the saints have embraced terrible things. This is why the numbers are small. Because the Lord is building leaders, shepherds, people who could do things that go beyond what instinct and what society proclaim is right. People who can carry the rod and lead the sheep into paths of righteousness. That's why he teaches us terrible things. And now we know that Christ miraculously grew his church by giving Hebrew Semites multi-sex partners. And that of black African heritage. The trip through Egypt wasn't that terrible after all, was it? I mean, come on, let's admit it. The Lord was proud of all the sons that came forward out of Egypt. And he didn't dismiss any of them as being illegitimate. The reason why it's interesting to focus on Egypt is because Egypt is the house of Ham. You've heard of Ham, right? Yeah. Noah had three sons. He had Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So you have the Shemites, the Hamites, and the Japhethites. David describes the excursion of Israel in this terminology. I'm reading Psalms 105, and let's read verses 6 through 27. O you seed of Abraham, his servant, you children of Jacob, his chosen, he is the Lord our God. His judgments are in all the earth. He hath remembered his covenant forever, the word which he commanded to a thousand generations. which covenant he made with Abraham, and his oath unto Isaac, and confirmed the same unto Jacob for a law, and to Israel for an everlasting covenant, saying, Unto thee will I give the land of Canaan, the lot of your inheritance. When they were but a few men in number, yea, very few, and strangers in it. We go back to what we read, don't we? That's what David's referring to. When they went from one nation to another, from one kingdom to another people, he suffered no man to do them wrong. Yea, he reproved kings for their sakes, saying, Touch not mine anointed, and do my prophets no harm. Moreover, he called for a famine upon the land. I told you that Christ engineered the famine, didn't I? It's a terrible thing, wasn't it? He broke the whole staff of bread. He sent a man before them, even Joseph, who was sold for a servant, whose feet they hurt with fetters. He was laid in iron. Until the time that his word came, the word of the Lord tried him. The king sent and loosed him, even the ruler of the people, and let him go free. He made him lord of his house and ruler of all his substance, to bind his princes at his pleasure and to teach his senators wisdom. Israel also came into Egypt, and Jacob sojourned in the land of Ham. And he increased his people greatly and made them stronger than their enemies. He turned their heart to hate his people, to deal subtly with his servants. He sent Moses, his servant, and Aaron, whom he had chosen, and they showed his signs among them and wonders in the land of Ham. Verse 37. He brought them forth also with silver and gold, and there was not one feeble person among their tribes. Well, that's amazing. Wasn't just one feeble person. How do you suppose that happened? I'm not here to carry the torch for the house of Egypt or to sing praises to the children of Africa or to extol the house of Ham. But the Lord took them through the Hamitic people to make them strong. That's how he engineered them. So that there was not one feeble person among them. Aren't you proud of this supposed terrible thing? If you read my latest newsletter, some people think that you cannot find anything good from Africa. We see from Psalms 105 that Israel was migratory. We know from prior scripture that's not going to continuously prevail. They didn't receive military skill from Egypt. They didn't receive the scientific prowess. If the Lord wanted them to have those things, he may have taken them to a different land. Although the Egyptians in that time were quite scientific in their own way. But that was not the point that the psalmist David is purveying to us about the benefits that they received from the house of Ham. Verse 37 says that they received strength. There's no feeble person among them. Verse 45 of Psalms 105, that they might observe his statutes and keep his laws. Praise ye the Lord. We could trace the path of Israel, and we have a lot of information and insight if we looked to the age of the kings, if we looked to the age of the Babylonian dispersion, if we looked to the age where they returned to the land, and then when they were dispersed throughout the world, and we could find different benefits that they garnered for themselves. But the people that came from Egypt had strength, and they had fidelity to the gospel. This is why he brought them to the house of Ham, that they might observe his statutes and keep his laws. Praise ye the Lord. They came forward as people of the highest spirituality. They came forward as people that were experts in discerning righteousness. There was something about that combination between the Semites and the Hamites that gave them this ability, and Christ worked it out. You saw in Genesis 46 how he told Jacob that he would increase their numbers. You find it amazing when you read about the creation story, how the Lord formed Adam with and all connected all his synapses, all his nerve connections, and all his blood vessels. When he breathed the breath of life into Adam, he could come forward as a living soul. Therefore, Christ being that potent and that powerful to do that, we must understand, therefore, that he did similar work with Israel in Egypt. He doesn't give you all the details, but the sons of Israel was no coincidence when they saw that Egyptian woman walking down the street, and then they sought after her and were successful in securing her affection and her love. And she was able to produce a seed that could be accounted worthy of the Lord's children. It's a good thing to be spiritual, isn't it? In fact, this is what the Lord looks at. We find in 1 Samuel chapter 16, he told Samuel when he was gathering the sons of Jesse to anoint a king, he says, look not on the outward appearance. The Lord doesn't look on the outward appearance. He looks on the heart. And we see here, because Psalms 105 makes no mention about their facial features, makes no mention about the texture of their hair, makes no mention about the complexion of their skin, only makes mention of their spirituality and their physical strength. Those other qualities, if the Lord found virtues, he could introduce to his people later on. But he needed to have people to love and embrace his law. But we need to understand one thing that could never be understood or discussed before. And it's an important lesson to learn. Because we as the brethren, we come from what appears to be a diversity of peoples. And we see now that we're all part of the house of David. We've shown that it doesn't matter whom a son of Israel marries. They may come out looking differently if he marries somebody from a Chinese extraction, or somebody from a European extraction, or somebody from a South American Indian extraction, or somebody from an African extraction. They're going to have the same spirituality. You would think, being ignorant of this concept and not understanding the genetics of the Bible, we think that we're smart as far as biology is concerned, but we miss this point. It's the house of your father that determines your spirituality. The mother may give you a different look. She may contribute differently. And one of these days we're going to explore what the contributions of the females are. But it's the males that give you your spirituality. You couldn't accept this light and this truth if you were prepared to embrace terrible things. And you couldn't embrace terrible things if you were not from the house of David. Therefore, you have these 600,000 people. They were not considered Hamitic. They were Semitic. And that was because they had that Y chromosome. The males did. And this is why the males were kept in power. Because it was through Israel's contribution, his sons, that allowed them to produce whatever the female's ethnicity is, produce a son that's going to have his personality, his spirituality. I'm taking a little bit of time, and I may be a little bit clumsy in presenting the point, but I just want you to understand that because they left Egypt by intermarrying the house of Ham, it didn't make their children Hamitic. And we don't understand why, because we don't understand genetics the way that we should. But the wife cannot transfer to the children her spirituality. But somehow or another, she could transfer the strength. If you went down into Egypt and married an Egyptian woman and you could only run the 40-yard dash in 5.0 seconds, but you sure knew how to sing praises to the Lord, and you married an Egyptian woman, and you know that son may be able to run the 40 in a 4.0. And he still will be able to sing praises to the Lord. This is the point that I'm trying to talk to you about. But the Christian church has disparaged him. Let's turn to Genesis chapter 9. I don't know how carefully you've followed history or followed the news over the past 25, 30 years. You remember South Africa, right? They had an apartheid system. And people, I don't think, have taken notice of this, but I was sharp to notice this. The Lord pointed out to me. The Protestant church that prevailed in South Africa justified their dominance of black people because they said that Noah cursed Ham. And then, to their credit, like I say, the church is on the sojourn, it's on travel, it's on move. To their credit, the elders of the Protestant church said this can no longer be considered true. This is not a basis or justification to oppress black people because of Noah's curse. And I remember reading or watching on news some of the people being interviewed, how disappointed they were with the church. We were always taught this. But you know what? After that, apartheid collapsed within a couple of years. They get that from what we read in Genesis chapter 9. Speaking of Noah, verse 25, it says, "And he said, cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren." Now, Canaan was the son of Ham that was cursed. But he was cursed by Noah. What does that mean? Who knows? Cush was also a son of Ham. But some people have used that and uncovered the fact that Ham and his sons populated Africa to insinuate that because you're of African heritage, that the Lord justifies your affliction and your oppression. And they do so because they don't have the light of Israel. People got all type of dumb ideas. I'm not here to express anger about any type of idea that they have. Some of them may personally hurt you more than others. But it was like, I mean, the Protestant church. I'm not the first one to tell you or to bring out the truth that it wasn't Ham that was cursed. It was Canaan. But the point that I bring out, that it doesn't matter whether Noah cursed Ham or not. Your redemption comes by embracing the testimony of Jesus. It frees you from all curses. The Lord told them in Deuteronomy 28, verses 12 through 14, and I'm reading it from my prepared notes here, "The Lord shall open unto thee his good treasures, and the Lord shall make thee the head and not the tail. And thou shalt be above only, and thou shalt not be beneath. If that thou hearken unto the commandments of the Lord thy God, which I command thee this day, to observe and to do them, and thou shalt not go aside to the right hand or to the left." The blessing of Israel was to come by doing what? By hearkening unto the commandments of the Lord God, which he commanded them this day. That presupposes any mandate that Noah may have commissioned in a time before that day. You can't forge a doctrine and call yourself legalistic by seeking to impose the mandate of Noah, or whatever you presume that it applies to, and consider yourself to be a fastidious adherent to the law. We saw in Psalms 105 that Israel came out of Egypt being expert practitioners of the law. Now, I know that they faltered, but their commission was to hearken to what he commanded them that day. And if he did not infer a curse on the Hamitic people, or on the Canaanite people, or on the Cushite people, the sons of Ham, then you could not oppress the stranger that was in your land. That was against the law. Because the Lord did not declare it. It didn't matter what Noah declared. Does that make sense to you? In fact, if you were to say, well, that person is from the house of Ham, therefore I'm going to oppress him, then the Lord's pronouncement against you was that he was going to kill you. That's what he said. Quite simply, Deuteronomy 10. And your wives will be widows and your sons and daughters will be fatherless. You were not allowed to oppress the stranger. That was part of the law. To infer any other conclusion means you go to the left and to the right. And really, your mind is simplistic, showing that you don't have the acuity of the light of Israel by thinking that you can identify a Semite or somebody from the house of Ham by looking at their face. That's not how they're identified. They're identified by the house of their father. But what about during the time of the Gentiles? Does Noah's curse become applicable during that time? That's important for us to understand because we're journeying along that trail right now. Let's read Deuteronomy chapter 32. That's Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 8. When the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. For the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is the lot of his inheritance. The people that ensued after the flood could have only come from, as we said, Ham, Japheth, and Shem. The Lord inherited Jacob. And he anticipated their number, and therefore he embraced Jacob as the apple of his eye, anticipating the day when their numbers would swell so that they could have preeminence over the nations. Therefore, all of the nations, wherever, whatever your nationality is, become subordinate to the house of Jacob. That's the Lord's portion. Therefore, John chapter 8 gives us a little bit more insight into addressing this question. I don't have a Bible study that explains the efficacy of Noah's curse. All I know is that we're told that we're going to be judged by the law and the testimony. And the testimony relinquishes anybody from being fearful of that curse. If you were cursed to be a servant, then you couldn't be a greater servant than a slave, right? The slave was perhaps the lowest level of being a servant. And the Lord spoke through that in John chapter 8, verse 34 through 36. And Jesus answered them, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, whosoever committeth sin is the servant of sin. And the servant abideth not in the house forever, but the son abideth ever. If the son therefore shall make you free, ye shall be free indeed." All of us are considered to be servants of sin. And the servant is not going to abide in the house eternally. Freedom comes when the Son of Man, as we find in John chapter 6, distributes the bread of life, the flesh and blood of Jesus. That's what makes you free. And if the servant makes you free, you're free indeed. It doesn't matter what Noah's commentary was. In fact, this points to the real reason for the wilderness journey. It is to escape curses. This is why the Star of David was to shine in brilliance in our day, so that we could receive freedom from the curses. We find this in Revelation chapter 2. It says in verse 26, "And he that overcometh and keepeth my works unto the end, to him will I give power over the nations." That's great. That's good news, isn't it? The Lord gives this servant, he refers to him in John 8 as the Son who's going to make you free. He gives you power over the nations. Those people, regardless what their ethnicity is, whether they be born to Ham, Shem, or Japheth, if they reject the Son, then they receive curses. "To him will I give power of the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron, as the vessel of the potter shall they be broken to shivers, even as I received of my Father, and I will give him the morning star." Revelation chapter 3, verse 21 and 22. "To him that overcometh will I grant to sit with me in my throne, even as I also overcame and am set down with my Father in his throne. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches." Jesus inherits the throne of David through the judicial proceedings in Daniel chapter 7. But he gives it to the saints. And this saint that he gives it to is representative of the one that he reveals terrible things. He is the overcomer. He gives him the authority to rule from Jerusalem. He gives him the morning star. He conveys Christ to him, and therefore he is able to judge the nations. Therefore, we began the journey going into Egypt. We went through Egypt, and we went through a period of enslavement. But the Lord made us stronger as a result. He continued us forward in the journey. We have never had a place in the history of the world whereby we could be settled. We've been on this path, this sojourn. We've learned terrible things. We've been told that we have to uproot ourselves. We've had to change. And one of the most difficult aspects of change is really the theology associated and attached to it. And consequently, when you see that there are adjustments and enlightenments that are born out of the scriptures to validate that you change and alter your doctrines, then you just merely should, by faith, understand that Christ, as he did with Jacob, is leading you. But this path leads to a house that we will rule eternally, and we shall never, never be moved therefrom. This is the end game of the journey, and this is what the Lord is opening up to us today as we examine our doctrine and as we advance in our truth. This is what we learn in Jeremiah chapter 31, our closing text, verses 22 through 27. "How long wilt thou go about, O thou backsliding daughter? For the Lord hath created a new thing in the earth. A woman shall compass a man." That's the union between Christ and David. I say it's the union between Christ and David because Christ hides himself upon David, and he walks in the midst of the church. "So the woman compasses the man. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, as yet they shall use this speech in the land of Judah and in the cities thereof, when I shall bring again their captivity. The Lord bless thee, O habitation of justice and mountain of holiness. This is the day when we're going to have complete and total justice. That's why it's referred to as the wilderness justice journey. And there shall dwell in Judah itself, and in all the cities thereof together, husbandmen, and they that go forth with flocks. We spoke to this earlier. This is the day where the Lord ordains his disciples to lead his flock. The husbandmen refer to proverbial men, people at the Lord's own heart, and the flock refer to his sheep. For I have satiated the weary soul and have replenished every sorrowful soul. Upon this I awakened and beheld, and my sleep was sweet unto me. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will sow the house of Israel and the house of Judah with the seed of men and with the seed of beasts. And it shall come to pass that like as I have watched over them to pluck them up and to break them down and to throw down and to destroy and to afflict, so I watch over them to build and to plant, saith the Lord. He takes the house of Judah and the house of Israel, and just as he did anciently by sowing them in Egypt, he sows them in the nations of the world. And like as we receive great benefit from our experience in the house of Ham, we will eventually be studying all the benefits that we received as we were sown amongst the seeds of the other nations of the world. And that's why he says, I will sow the house of Israel and the house of Judah with the seed of man and with the seed of beast. Of course, we understand that the seed of men means the seed of rulers, and the seed of beast means the seed of the people that are the followers. The Lord has carefully, over these 6,000 years, reconstituted his people. He's recreating us after his own image, and he's installing within Israel all the capacities that they need to govern the planet. And he does so by intermarrying them with the daughters of humanity. And that brings them to the wilderness justice journey. With that, I bring the study to a close.